going. And I think that's about everything. Oh, except for this. He drew a tiny cross next to the harbour and wrote, "We are here." "That's the most beautiful map I have ever seen," said Ellen truthfully. She had never had any interest in maps before, but she already knew she would keep this forever. A faint shadow crossed Patrick's face. It came and went so fast she couldn't tell if it was sadness or anger, or maybe embarrassment, or if she'd imagined it. Then he smiled at her. "No charge this time, darling." Her heart was melting all over the place.
"I've got this box. Sometimes I think if I just threw away the box, I might be able to stop. Once I got as far as carrying it out to the rubbish bin, I opened the lid of the bin and smelled rotting food and heard the buzz of flies, and I thought, this isn't rubbish. This is my life. I lost them tonight. They were going somewhere near Milson's Point or Kirribilli. I was hungry, so I didn't bother driving around looking for his car. I came home and ate sardines on toast while I watched Cold Case with the box on the floor next to me. Every commercial break, I dipped my hand into the box and pulled something out at random. Then I would examine it as if it was a clue or a solution, as if I was one of the detectives on Cold Case trying to unravel the secrets of the past. A birthday card. The cardboard still stiff and shiny, not faded at all. It could have been given to me yesterday. Dear Saskia, happy birthday from your boys. We love you, Patrick and Jack. Kiss, kiss. A photo of me and Jack with one of our Play-Doh cities. We spent hours making those cities. I'd spread out cardboard across the dining room table, and we'd put in roads and roundabouts and traffic lights, shops and houses. We'd spend days working on the one city, Jacksville, Jackland, Jacktown. I loved building those cities as much as he did. It was like being a town planner without the politics or paperwork. A boarding pass for Queenstown, New Zealand. Patrick and I went snowboarding for a week. His mum looked after Jack. I remember Patrick stopping to kiss me when we walked back inside for a hot chocolate. Warm lips. Cold snowflakes falling around us as soft as caresses. A map that Patrick drew for me when he was giving me directions to a developer's office near the airport. I remember I said to him, "That's the most beautiful map I've ever seen." Chapter 4. In this act, stalking includes the following of a person about, or the watching or frequenting of the vicinity of, or an approach to a person's place of residence, business or work, or any place that a person frequents for the purposes of any social or leisure activity. Section 8 of the Crimes, Domestic and Personal Violence Act.
So she follows you? Everywhere? How is that even possible?
Well, not everywhere. The last time we were at the movies.
Maybe she just happened to be there.
Maybe, but she tried to get into the same restaurant, and then she left a letter on his car windscreen, which he didn't read. Apparently, she waits around the corner from Patrick's house and follows his car. He said if he's going somewhere different, he'll often lose her, but if it's a regular place, like the movies at Cremorne, it's easy for her to work out.
Good Lord!
I know.
This must be awful for you. It's ruining that wonderful time at the start of your relationship. You should be gazing moonily into each other's eyes, not keeping a lookout for his crazy ex.
I don't mind. Actually, I find it sort of interesting.
You freak.
Ellen laughed at Julia's decisive tone and stretched luxuriously. It was a Saturday morning and they'd just been swimming at their local pool. Now they were lying on white towels in the billowing heat of the sauna. Ellen's legs and shoulders ached from the swim. Julia always made her swim harder and faster than she would if she was on her own. She could feel beads of sweat sliding all over her body, down her back, into her cleavage. She let her hands rest lightly on her thighs and felt sleek and slippery and sensual. There was no problem practicing mindfulness when you were at the start of a relationship. It happened automatically, all that sex, all those chemicals zipping through your body, and all that appreciation. That was what was so wonderful about falling in love. Patrick appeared to highly approve of every new thing he learned about her body, her past, her personality. It made Ellen not just sexier, but funnier, smarter, nicer, kinder, all round lovelier. She was invincible. Her life seemed to flow and ripple in exquisite harmony as if she'd achieved enlightenment. Her clients were sweet and grateful, her friends adorable, her mother not at all frustrating. "So, when am I going to meet him?" she said on the phone, her tone warm and pleased, sounding just like a normal mother presumably would. Whatever grocery items Ellen wanted were always right on the shelf in front of her. Traffic lights turned green as she approached. Her car keys, sunglasses, and purse sat obediently and conveniently on the hall table. This morning, she'd had just 1 hour to go to the bank, the motor registry, and the dry cleaners, and she'd done it all with time to spare. And every person she dealt with, even at the motor registry, had been charming. She'd had quite an emotional conversation with the bank teller about the weather. The teller was from the UK and thought that Australian winters were divine, and Ellen had felt tearily proud, as if she, in her invincible state, was solely responsible for the Australian climate. If only she could bottle this feeling and make it last forever. It couldn't last forever. Her rational mind knew that, but her heart, her foolish heart, was chirping. Oh, yes, it can! Why not? This is who you are now. This is your life from now on. I would never humiliate myself like that, said Julia. What? Oh, the stalking thing. Well, I guess she just can't let go, said Ellen. Right now, she was filled with gentle compassion for all of humanity. Julia snorted. She was lying on the bench opposite Ellen, a towel wrapped like a turban about her head. She had a long, lean, athletic body and crazy blonde curly hair, and she hovered right on the edge of being extremely beautiful. Whenever Ellen walked along the street with her, she saw men's eyes involuntarily flicking back to Julia for a second appraising look. Unfortunately, Julia's beauty seemed to attract a certain type of man, the sort who appreciated quality and was prepared to pay extra for it. The problem was, these men constantly upgraded their computers, their cars, and their women. That was their nature. They were dedicated consumers, excellent for the economy. After nearly 5 years of marriage, Julia's husband, William, had decided it was high time he upgraded to the latest brand of woman, a 23-year-old brunette. Ellen always liked to think that the sort of man she herself attracted was automatically superior to those who chose Julia because they didn't let the billboards determine what was beautiful. They weren't superficial, they were individuals. Sadly, she couldn't really back this theory up when her relationship history was just as disastrous as Julia's. Really, when she dug deep, she saw that her whole theory was just her way of making herself feel better because the majority of men didn't feel the need to give her that second flick of the eyes. Although William had been a dreadful prat. To be honest, she had been quite fond of him in the beginning. "Where's the woman's self-respect?" snapped Julia. "Just move on, for God's sake. She's making all of us look bad." There was a real edge to her voice, as if she was personally offended. "You mean she's making women look bad?" said Ellen. "It's normally men who do the stalking. It's good. She's showing women can stalk just as effectively as men." Julia made a pfft sound. She sat up, leaned down with one long arm, and picked up the ladle lying next to a bucket of water. She threw it on the hot rocks. There was a boiling hiss, and the sauna filled with more steam. "Julia," gasped Ellen, "I'm suffocating." "Toughen up," said Julia. She lay back down and asked, "What's this girl's name?" "Saskia," said Ellen, breathing shallow breaths of the hot, heavy air. She felt shy saying it out loud, as if it was a celebrity's name. "Have you actually seen her yet? Or have you seen photos?" "No, he never tells me he's seen her until after she's left. I'm desperate to see what she looks like." "Maybe she's a figment of his imagination, and he's the crazy one." "I don't think so. Patrick wasn't crazy. He was lovely." "So I assume he ended the relationship." "He just said that it ran its course." "So he broke her heart," said Julia sternly. "Well, I don't..." "Still, it's no excuse. It happens to all of us. Patrick should take a restraining order against her. Has he done that?" Julia believed there were solutions to everything. "He says he's been to the police," began Ellen, but then she stopped and didn't bother to go into further detail.
She wasn't entirely convinced that Patrick had told her the whole story about why he hadn't gone ahead with the restraining order. "Anyway, the silly woman just needs to pull herself together," said Julia, as if it was up to Ellen to pass on this instruction. "Yes." They lay there in silence for a few moments. Ellen was planning what she'd cook Patrick for dinner that night. He'd already cooked once for her on a night when Jack was staying at a friend's place. It had been a very nice, plain roast dinner. Nothing too fancy, which was good, because she'd been out with men who fancy themselves gourmet cooks. It seemed like such an asset in the beginning, but then they were always so vain about it, hovering around the kitchen, criticizing the way she chopped the garlic. Maybe she should do something with pork, seeing as he'd ordered the pork belly. Some nice, tender pork medallions. "Do you remember Eddie Masters?" said Julia. "The butcher's apprentice," said Ellen, remembering a skinny, long-haired boy in a blue and white striped butcher's apron. Julia had gone out with him when they were in their teens. Yes, pork. She would stop by that expensive butcher in the arcade on the way home from the pool. "He went out with Cheryl from the chemist after me," said Julia. "The scary-looking girl. Actually, I think I just thought she was scary because she had her ears pierced twice." "Yes, well, after Eddie dumped me, I used to ring her house all the time. If she answered, I'd just sit there, not saying anything, until she hung up. She'd scream all this abuse at me, and I'd just sit there, breathing. Not heavy breathing, just breathing, so she knew I was there." "Julia Margaret Robertson!" Ellen sat up quickly, half pretending and half genuinely shocked. She looked at her friend, who was still lying with her hands clasped on her front. Julia had been school captain of the snooty private girls' school they'd both attended. She'd been slumming it with the butcher. Julia didn't open her eyes. She smiled devilishly. "I was thinking about your stalker and I remembered it," she said. "I hadn't thought about it for ages." "But it's so unlike you." "I know, but I was shattered when he dumped me. I couldn't stop thinking about her, about why he chose her over me. I felt as if I didn't exist anymore. Ringing her up somehow made me exist. It was like an addiction. I hated myself afterward, and I'd think I'm never doing that again. But then the next thing, I'd find myself dialing her number." "How did you stop?" "I don't know. I guess I just got over him." Julia paused and said, "You know what? Eddie the butcher was a beautiful kisser." "Didn't he have a goatee?" said Ellen. "A really wispy one, like a bit of fairy floss hanging off his chin?" "Yes. And do you remember how he kept his packet of cigarettes stuffed into the sleeve of his t-shirt? It looked like a growth on his arm. I thought it was unbearably sexy." They didn't say anything for a few seconds, and then they both dissolved into the sort of helpless, wheezing laughter unique to women who had spent their school days together. "You should look Eddie up on Facebook," said Ellen when they'd stopped laughing. "He probably has his own butcher shop by now." "Oh, God, I'm not that desperate," said Julia. "Anyway, I'm perfectly happy being single." "You're lying, my dear friend," thought Ellen, covertly observing Julia's body language. Clenched hands, compressed lips. It had been 2 years since Julia's ex-husband had upgraded to the brunette. Julia lifted her head suddenly. "You didn't just make up that whole story about the stalker, did you? Is it a fable you've made up and the subliminal message is that I'm like the crazy stalker and I need to move on and start dating?" "What are you talking about?" But Ellen knew exactly what she was talking about. "I remember you told me once about that famous hypnotist, your hero or whatever, the guy who wore the purple cape." "Milton Erickson," sighed Ellen. "Gosh, you've got a good memory." People were always underestimating Julia. It was because she was so beautiful and also because she had the sense of humor of a 14-year-old boy. "You said he used to treat patients by telling stories," continued Julia. "He used therapeutic metaphors," murmured Ellen. "Well, I've noticed that ever since William left me, you've been casually telling me these little motivational stories about people overcoming obstacles, finding happiness after heartbreak."
"I have not," said Ellen.
She had.
"Hmm,"
said Julia. She lifted her chin and smiled at Ellen. Ellen grinned sheepishly back at her.
"So Patrick's stalker isn't a therapeutic metaphor?"
"She is not," said Ellen.
They lay in silence for a few seconds.
So this Patrick has a crazy ex-girlfriend and a dead wife, said Julia. Sounds like a real catch. No complications whatsoever.
It doesn't feel complicated, said Ellen.
Yet,
said Julia.
Thanks for your enthusiastic support, said Ellen. Just saying.
Julia sat up and took her towel off her head and dabbed it against her pink, shiny cheeks.
I bet you love the fact that he's a widower, don't you? She said. It makes him seem like a romantic, tragic figure.
It's just like Miles.
Miles?
Miles, that one-legged boy you fell in love with in high school.
Giles, said Ellen.
And we all fell in love with the one-legged boy. He was gorgeous. This was the problem with being friends with someone who knew you when you were a teenager. They never quite take you seriously because they always see you as your stupid teenage self. It was true that she wasn't unhappy about Patrick being a widower. She quite liked the fact that it made things more complicated. It made her feel like she was part of the rich tapestry of life and death. Also, it gave her a chance to demonstrate her professional skills. She imagined people saying to her, "Do you worry about his feelings for his wife?" And she'd say serenely, "No, actually, I don't." She would understand completely if he still had feelings for his wife. She would know instinctively when to draw back, when to let him grieve for her.
"I never fell in love with a one-legged boy," said Julia.
"No, you were too busy breathing down the phone line to your ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend."
"Aha! Touché!"
Julia expertly flourished an imaginary sword. She'd been the school's fencing champion. She twisted the towel back around her head and lay down on the bench again. "Anyway, I've got an excuse for my stalkerish behavior," she said. "I was 17. Teenagers don't have properly formed brains. It's a medical fact. How old is your stalker?"
"She's Patrick's stalker, not mine. She's in her early 40s, I think."
It was like pulling teeth getting the basic facts out of Patrick about Saskia. Ella noticed that he avoided using her name wherever possible. He called her "that woman" or "bunny boiler."
"There you go. She's a grown-up woman. A middle-aged woman, in fact. No excuse. She's loopy. Loony bin material."
Ellen sighed and stretched out her arms and legs as hard as she could before releasing them and letting her body melt into the bench. "We're all a little crazy, Julia." Chapter 5. You will lose weight. You can become just as slim as you choose to be. Look at the differences between these suggestions. The first could be described as authoritative, paternal, and direct. The second could be described as permissive, indirect, and maternal. Milton Erickson believed that the unconscious mind would resist authoritarian suggestions. He was the first to use artful vagueness. Don't you just love that phrase? Excerpt from an advanced hypnotherapy class delivered by Ellen O'Farrell. Three students nodded, the rest stared at her. Artfully vague. The news that she was unexpectedly meeting Patrick's son that night for the first time caused Ellen to feel a completely out-of-proportion sense of panic.
"Sure, of course, of course,"
she said to Patrick, nodding her head like a maniacal puppet when he rang to ask if it was okay to bring Jack along with him to dinner tonight because the kid from school he'd been planning to visit had come down with some virus.
"He can just eat whatever we're eating," said Patrick. "Or we'll just order him a pizza, or whatever. Don't stress. Oh, and he'll bring along a DVD to watch."
So what, should she give the child a sliver of each of their pork medallions? Should she rush out and buy him a lamb chop? But there wasn't time. She was seeing two clients that afternoon, and the first one was due in 5 minutes. All she had to drink was champagne and wine. She needed Coke, or lemonade, or at the very least, juice. She had strawberries and liqueur and King Island cream for dessert, entirely inappropriate for a child. He'd expect ice cream. Cake. Cupcakes? Too childish? She mustn't insult him by treating him like a little kid. Good Lord. She needed hours to prepare for this. She needed to ring her friend Madeline, who was the expert on all things children. To text Julia, who would tell her she was being an idiot. To email her friend Carmel in New York, who would order her a book on Amazon with a title like The Secret to Positive Stepmothering. To Google,
8-year-old boys and how to talk to them without appearing desperate to be their mother. When she and Patrick had talked about her meeting Jack for the first time, they'd agreed that it would be during the day, not at night. Probably a trip to the aquarium, some sort of activity to keep the pressure off. She had planned to make funny, interesting, seemingly off-the-cuff but actually carefully scripted remarks about fish that would appeal to an 8-year-old boy. She felt a chill as she remembered something else. Her DVD player wasn't working. The poor motherless child would be bored out of his mind. Games! They'd have to play games. Did children still play board games? Or should they just sit around and talk? But what about? For a moment, she actually felt close to tears. She needed to reframe this problem in a more positive light. Ellen, he's a kid, not the Queen of England or the President of the United States. Well, that wasn't at all helpful because actually Ellen would be more comfortable meeting the Queen or the President. The Queen reminded her of her grandmother, whom she missed every day, and President Obama seemed like a jovial, chatty sort of fellow. Ellen was an only child who had grown up around adults, and her job brought her into contact with new people all the time. She wasn't shy, and although she had a tendency for self-loathing, working on this was an ongoing self-improvement project, she didn't really feel socially inferior to anyone, except children. Yes, truthfully, she felt inferior to children. They were their own species with their own language and culture. They seem so full of self-confidence these days. When she'd gone to the shops today after the pool, a little girl, whom Ellen wouldn't have thought had been more than 8, went gliding by, chatting away into a pink mobile phone. She was wearing a fur-lined hooded coat, her face was painted like a tiger, and she was gliding because her sneakers appeared to have tiny wheels magically hidden in the soles. Not only that, her shoes had flashing pink lights along the side. Ellen had stared, full of wonder, at this exotic tiger princess on her invisible skates. A few of her friends had babies, but babies were easy. You could cuddle them and make them laugh just by tickling their palms or blowing raspberries into their soft, sweet necks. Oh, she adored babies. But kids? Actually, in spite of the fact that she was in her mid-30s, many of her friends of similar age were childless. "You girls all think you've got forever," her mother said. "You do realize that you're born with all the eggs you're going to get? Not that I'm in any rush to be turned into a wrinkly, grey-haired old granny." A clipped laugh. Okay, so Ellen didn't have much experience dealing with children. But it had to be more than that causing this sense of panic. She peeled back the layers of her consciousness with brutal efficiency to reveal the naked, hairy truth. She wanted to be this child's stepmother. She wanted him dressed in a cute little suit at her wedding. She wanted him to be a big brother to her own little baby because she was 35 and born with all the eggs she was going to get. She wanted his daddy to be the one because she couldn't stand to look up another profile on that awful internet dating site and find another middle-aged, bald, chubby man staring smugly at her out of the computer screen demanding a slim lady who takes care of herself for snuggles and long walks along the beach. Yes, she wanted this child to love her and approve of her and save her from snuggles with chubby, smug men. And of course, that was all too much and all too soon and all very embarrassing. And if the kid sensed her crazy desperation and she suspected that children were like dogs with an instinct for fear, then he would... The doorbell rang in an impatient way. Ellen looked at her watch. It was her 2 o'clock client. She ran down the stairs, 2 at a time, then stopped at the bottom and recited her standard pre-appointment affirmation. "Breathe in. I am now fully present with this client. Breathe out. I will give everything I have to give." She opened the door, smiling calmly and professionally. Neurotic Ellen was now safely stashed away in a closed cupboard at the back of her mind. The client was Rosie, her bride-to-be who had promised her fiancé that she would give up smoking by her wedding day. She was a short, curvy woman with big, trusting, round eyes and a tiny gap between her 2 front teeth, giving her an innocent, childlike look. Ellen couldn't actually imagine her smoking. It would be like watching a toddler with a cigarette in her mouth. At their first session, Rosie had mentioned that she was marrying Ian Roman and given Ellen an expectant look. "I'm meant to recognize that name," thought Ellen. He's in the media, said Rosie. He's quite, prominent.
And then Ellen thought, Ian Roman. It was one of those names that sank into your subconscious via osmosis. He owned newspapers or television stations or something. His name appeared in the financial pages. Not that Ellen made a habit of reading the financial pages.
So my married name will be Rosie Roman. Rosie gave an artificial little laugh.
You don't have to change your name, pointed out Ellen.
Oh no, I'm not a career woman or anything.
Rosie waved her hand dismissively as if she'd been offered something far too expensive for her tastes.
I'm just an ordinary person.
Rosie seemed in a bad mood today, moving her head from side to side as if her neck was sore, and then pulling hard on the hem of her jumper as though it had shrunk in the wash.
How are the wedding plans going?
Asked Ellen, leading her up the stairs.
Don't ask, said Rosie.
Oh dear.
Stupid time to give up smoking when I'm stressed out of my mind.
Not necessarily. It's often a good time to break a habit when you're out of your day-to-day routine.
I guess.
Rosie didn't seem convinced. Ellen watched Rosie's shoulders relax as they walked into her glass office. The combination of the light and the ocean view was so powerful that sometimes she thought she probably didn't need to do much else for her clients but allow them to sit there.
So, how's it going?
Asked Ellen when they were sitting down.
I'm still smoking like a chimney,
snapped Rosie. Before Ellen had a chance to respond, Rosie said,
I'm sorry, it's not your fault. I know it's my fault. I haven't been listening to the CD you gave me.
Ellen had given her one of her CDs with a specially prepared script for breaking the smoking habit. She'd made them years ago, and clients were often effusive about them, although she found it unbearable to listen to her own voice.
Why haven't you been listening to it?
Many clients didn't get around to listening to her CDs, and they always told her this with guilty, defiant looks, as if they were admitting they hadn't done their homework, but they knew they really couldn't get into trouble because they were grown-ups and were paying for this. Rosie shrugged.
I don't know. I just can't seem to think of anything else besides the wedding. Like, for example, I despise the color I picked for the bridesmaids' dresses. Apricot. It was like I was suffering temporary insanity.
She lifted a chocolate out of the bowl and then dropped it again.
My fiancé gave up smoking years ago. He just decided one day when he was driving along the F3, he wound down his window, threw out the half-full packet of cigarettes, and never smoked again.
Litterbug, said Ellen. Rosie looked at her with surprise and giggled.
Yes.
Then her smile vanished abruptly as if she'd been caught out.
There was something not quite right here.
Ellen had a feeling that Rosie was lying to her about something. People were always lying, of course, whether consciously or not.
Do you want to give up smoking? Said Ellen.
Rosie widened her eyes.
Of course. Well, sometimes there are unconscious blocks to letting go of a habit. I'm thinking we might do something a bit different and explore that today. Sure, sighed Rosie. Although I can tell you, there's nothing mysterious about it. I just need more willpower.
Well, let's see. Ellen paused, trying to decide on what induction to use. Then she knew the perfect metaphor.
What color do you wish you'd chosen for your bridesmaids?
Blue, said Rosie immediately.
Okay, would you like to choose a spot on the wall to focus on? Anywhere you like.
Rosie sighed and shrugged and looked around the room. She kept her eyes fixed on the same spot in the far right-hand corner that almost everyone chose and said,
Okay.
Soon you will blink. Rosie blinked.
That's right, said Ellen warmly. And sooner or later, your eyes are going to close. It might happen straight away, or it might take a little longer.
Rosie closed her eyes. Ellen watched Rosie's chest rise and fall and let her own breathing fall into the same rhythm. She spoke rapidly and smoothly, imagining her words pouring into Rosie's mind like liquid from a jar. I'm wondering if you can visualize a wall. And I'm sorry to tell you that it's painted apricot. But the good news is, you're repainting it an exquisite blue. Your paintbrush is moving up and down in rhythmic strokes. Up and down. Up and down. Too complicated?
Ellen had found she needed to be careful with her metaphors. Men often got too literal, A man might say afterward, "You should have had me paint an undercoat first." Women tended to go off on tangents. One of her earliest clients had said she'd love to sunbake, so Ellen did what she thought was a pretty safe induction about lying on a tropical beach. Afterward, the client admitted she'd spent the whole time trying to choose which swimsuit to visualize herself wearing. Ellen watched Rosie's eyes move rapidly behind her eyelids and noted the tension in her body. Her shoulders up, her hands gripping the sides of the chair, her fingers pressing hard into the leather. A cloud moved across the sun outside the window, and a beam of light caught the diamonds of Rosie's chunky engagement ring. "Each time you see that paintbrush move, notice your body sink into a deeper feeling of relaxation. You'll probably find your breathing is starting to flow in rhythm with the paintbrush. Up, down, in, out. Up and down, in and out." She watched Rosie's tiny, pixie-like black boots fall outward in a V-shape. "Watch their feet," her mentor Flynn used to tell her. "That's the giveaway." The wall is nearly finished. By the time it's entirely blue, or perhaps a little while later, you will be enjoying the most glorious state of relaxation you have ever experienced. Rosie's mouth drooped, her face sagged, and her head lolled to one side. If some of her clients knew how they looked when they were in a trance, they would be horrified. It was something that Ellen had never mentioned to anyone, not even to other therapists. It felt like something deeply personal she shared with her clients. "Okay, Ellen, just exactly what are you going to do with this blue wall you've got in front of you?" But she knew. Sometimes her work felt clumsy and forced. Other days, like now, it felt natural and fluid. She was in a light trance herself. She was in the zone. "Rosie, you have the power to turn that wall into a deep, rich blue curtain like you might see on a stage. And behind that curtain, somebody important is waiting for you. I don't know who, but it's someone with great wisdom, someone you trust implicitly. You're pulling back the curtain and that person is waiting for you. Maybe they're stepping forward to hug you." She waited and watched. "Are you with that person?" Rosie lifted her right index finger, the signal they'd agreed upon for yes. "Now, it's my belief that this person has something to share with you. They might be able to tell you why you're finding it hard to give up smoking, or give you the resources or strength you need to break this habit. I'm going to be quiet now while you listen to what they have to say." A cloud moved across the sun again, and the room filled with warmth. Ellen could feel her own chest rising and falling in perfect rhythm with Rosie's. Rosie's face remained impassive, but she was chewing at her lip. After a few seconds, Ellen spoke again. "Rosie," she said, "I'm wondering if you would like to share with me what you've learned. It's entirely up to you." For a moment, Rosie said nothing, and then she spoke. Her voice was a husky, slow monotone. "I don't want to marry him," she said. "That's why I don't want to give up smoking, because I don't want to be married." Ellen's eyebrows shot up, and her eyes went to the cluster of shimmering diamonds on Rosie's finger. "I don't really like him all that much," said Rosie.
"So, this is my son, Jack."
Patrick stood in Ellen's hallway with his hands resting on his son's skinny shoulders.
"Well, hi, Jack. How are you?"
Ellen sounded exactly as she'd been afraid she would, like a librarian at story hour.
"Good, thanks."
The boy glanced briefly up at Ellen and then looked away again. He had his father's slightly almond-shaped pale green eyes. His thick blonde hair was long and messy, cut over his ears like a 1960s rock star.
"Good. Well, so, great. I'm hoping you like sausage sandwiches."
To her joyous relief, Ellen had discovered some sausages in the freezer before they'd arrived. Jack didn't appear to have heard her. He had his chin down and was tugging at the front of his T-shirt, as if he was checking the fabric for strength. Patrick cleared his throat.
"Ellen asked you a question, mate."
"No, she didn't."
Yes, she did. She asked if you like sausages. You love sausages, don't you?
Jack shrugged his shoulders away from his father's hands.
I don't love sausages, actually, Dad. Also, she didn't ask if I like sausages. She said, I'm hoping you like sausage sandwiches. That's not a question. It's like a sentence, see? She said, I'm hoping you like sausage.
Okay, well, began Ellen.
I love pizza. You said I could order a pizza tonight.
I said maybe we'd order a pizza tonight, but if Ellen has made sausage sandwiches for you, then that's what you're having.
Patrick gave Jack a stern, paternal and somewhat panicky look.
I haven't actually made them yet, Ellen hastened to say. You can have pizza, Jack, if that's what you prefer. Of course you can.
Yeah, thanks, that's what I'd prefer.
Jack sighed gustily as if someone was finally talking sense.
So, can I watch my DVD now?
Jack, please, you don't need to watch your DVD straight away. That's not good manners.
Ellen saw that Patrick's cheeks were sucked in as if he was clenching his jaw. He was desperate for Jack to make a good impression on her. Her own nerves vanished.
It's all right, she said to Jack. My DVD player isn't working, but you can watch it on my laptop, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay, said Jack kindly. I can work your laptop.
For the first time, he tilted his head up to look at her properly.
You must be disappointed about your friend being sick, she said to him.
Yeah, he said impatiently.
Hey, will you please hypnotize me? Also, could you teach me how to hypnotize my friends? Like, so they do whatever I command? That would be so cool. They could be my slaves.
That's sort of unethical, said Ellen.
What?
Okay, let's get that DVD on. Patrick clapped his hands together.
You're acting really weird, Dad, Jack frowned.
Patrick gave Ellen a self-conscious grin. Weirder than usual, hey, Jack?
Jack shook his head gravely. Seriously, Dad.
They headed down the hallway, and Jack stopped to touch a fingertip to the silver metallic polka dots on the orange wallpaper. He looked back up at Ellen.
This is a cool house.
Thank you. She was so smitten, she only just managed to stop herself from calling him darling. 20 minutes later, Jack was sitting in Ellen's living room with a laptop on his knees, headphones over his ears, his eyes fixed on the flickering images on the screen, and his big chunky sneakers up on Ellen's beautifully restored retro coffee table. Patrick didn't tell him to take his feet off the table, and Ellen didn't know how to ask him to take his feet down without sounding like an evil stepmother. What did a few scuff marks matter?
Well, he's gorgeous, she told Patrick when they were sitting at the dining room table.
She had laid out a platter of sourdough bread and dips and big green olives. They could see the top of Jack's head where he sat watching his DVD through the dining room door. She lowered her voice slightly, even though he obviously couldn't hear them.
He has his moments, said Patrick. He cleared his throat and smiled at her. You're the first woman I've introduced him to since his mother died.
Well, that's an honor. But wait, didn't you introduce him to Saskia? I mean, you said you lived together for a couple of years, so she must have lived with Jack too.
She hadn't thought about that before. Saskia had known Patrick's little boy as well.
Patrick's nostrils twitched as if he'd just smelled something unpleasant. He spat an olive stone out into the palm of his hand.
I don't count her.
Ellen was unsettled. He couldn't just pretend Saskia had never existed. He must have loved her once, in the beginning. And Ellen was not the first woman he'd introduced to his son. That was factually incorrect. She didn't like that.
How old was Jack when Saskia lived with you?
He was a toddler, I guess.
And did they get on? Was he upset when she left?
He doesn't even remember her, said Patrick dismissively, which didn't answer her question at all. His eyes lost their focus on her, and he suddenly called out,
Jack, get your feet off the table!
How could he see that Jack had his feet on the table from here? Or had he noticed before and not bothered to say anything?
Excuse me.
Patrick stood up and went into the other room. When he came back, he was all set for a new subject.
So, how was your day today? You had a couple of clients, you said. Were they good, sessions?
If she knew him better, she would have said, I haven't finished talking about Saskia and Jack. But she was always struggling to contain her possibly voyeuristic interest in his ex-girlfriend.
After all, he didn't seem to want to know anything about her ex-partners. So she told him about her session with Rosie and how she'd discovered that the reason she didn't want to give up smoking was because she didn't really want to get married. Of course, Ellen was careful not to reveal any names or the fact that the cancellation of the wedding would probably make the social pages of the Sydney papers. She thought it was an interesting topic of conversation that showed her in a good light. Patrick listened intently, and then he squinted at her as if he were trying to see through sunlight. It made him look older. He had deep lines on either side of his eyes, she guessed from all that outdoors work as a surveyor. He said, "She's calling off the wedding because of you?" "Well, I don't know exactly what she's going to do next. That's up to her. I guess I just helped her see how she really felt." "But imagine how that poor bloke is going to feel. Are you sure it's not just a case of cold feet? Or maybe she's just looking for an excuse for why she can't give up smoking?" Ellen felt irritated. She had been expecting fascination and even awe over what hypnotherapy could achieve. She scratched at a spot on her wrist. Irritability always manifested itself as an itchy feeling on her right wrist, in the exact spot where she had suffered dermatitis as a child. "I don't make my clients do anything," she said. "I help them to bypass the critical factor and directly access their unconscious minds. My client had what's called a mini Satori. It's the Zen word for enlightenment." Ellen thought back to the end of her appointment with Rosie. After she had come out with a revelation about her marriage, Ellen had given her a post-hypnotic suggestion. "When you come out of this trance, you will feel calm and in control as you make your decisions about what you want to do next." When Rosie had emerged from her trance, she had blinked and immediately held up her hand to look at her engagement ring. She slid the ring from her finger and held it up to the light with her fingertips, looking at it curiously like it was a strange and unpleasant scientific specimen. Then she smiled at Ellen and said, "You know what? I don't even like the ring." "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply any criticism," said Patrick. "I guess I just identify too much with the man." "It's okay," said Ellen. This was the first time there had been the slightest hint of tetchiness between them. It had to happen, she told herself. There was no need for alarm. "I saw one of those stage shows once," he said, "you know, where they call people out of the audience to hypnotize them. I have to admit, and I hope this doesn't offend you, but I'm assuming stage hypnotists are very different from, you know, proper hypnotherapists like you. But the thing is, I sort of hated it." Ellen smiled at his guilty expression. "That's fine," she said. "It's completely different from what I do. I hated the stupid looks on their faces," he demonstrated by slumping back in his chair and letting his chin drop to his chest. He straightened back up and took a sip of his wine. "They look so pathetic. It was like he drugged them and he could make them do whatever he wanted." "He couldn't really. They were still in control. He just helped them lose their inhibitions," said Ellen. "I like to be in control," said Patrick. "That's why I've never been a big drinker. I've never taken drugs. I want to be in the driver's seat all the time, so to speak." He paused, took another olive, and then delicately placed it back down on the plate in front of him. He kept his eyes fixed on the olive. "That's what I hate most about this thing with my ex. She's in control. She affects my life, and I don't get any say in it, and there's not a thing I can do about it. So I'm sorry if I sometimes seem a bit weird about her. It's just that when we're talking about her, it's like she's in the room with us." He looked up at her with the same pleading, desperate expression of the many clients who came to her seeking a solution they didn't really believe she was capable of providing, and Ellen experienced a sudden tiny shock of sympathy. It had been all false bravado on that first night when he'd told her about his stalker. Of course he was damaged by it. He was a stalking victim. It had been incredibly insensitive of her not to even think about this before. She had been so interested in Saskia and trying to understand her motivations, she hadn't even properly considered the potential impact on Patrick. She was behaving as if only women felt real emotions, as if men were somehow a less complex life form. "I'm sorry," she said. "When I was asking all those questions about Saskia, I hadn't thought about how she's the last person you want to talk about. I mean, the way this must affect you, it must be, well, Obviously, I've got no idea what it must be like. Patrick was still looking at her, straight in the eyes. There was some complicated feeling he was trying to convey to her. Perhaps he was having his own mini Satori. He leaned forward. She leaned forward too. Good. He was going to share. This was going to take their relationship to a new, deeper, more spiritual, more profound level. Do you want to go upstairs for a few minutes? He said. And I think he's going to tell me something profound and meaningful, and it turns out he just wants a quickie with his son right there. Sex was the furthest thing from my mind. It's always the first thing on their mind, said Ellen's friend Madeline. They were talking on the phone. Ellen was filing paperwork in her office, and she could tell by the hissing and clattering that Madeline was cooking, probably something elegant and organic, and probably with a floral apron tied around her pregnant waist. Madeline was glowingly pregnant with her second child. She and Ellen had shared a flat when they were in their 20s, back when Madeline would have fallen about laughing at the thought of her ever wearing a floral apron. Ellen would have called Julia, but she'd found that Julia's interest in hearing about Patrick had ever so slightly cooled as the relationship progressed. Even before Julia's divorce, she'd always been the sort of friend you called when things were going badly rather than when they were going well. Now that Patrick was officially Ellen's boyfriend, there was just the tiniest hint of contempt in Julia's voice when Ellen mentioned anything about him, unless it involved his crazy ex-girlfriend. She loved hearing about Saskia. It wasn't that she didn't want Ellen to be happy, it was just that she didn't think there was much to say about happiness. Madeline, on the other hand, was a sort of friend who cared deeply, but was hopelessly inept when things were going badly, who panicked and changed the subject fast if someone's voice so much as trembled with emotion. Now Ellen frowned at the dismissive tone in Madeline's voice. That's not true. That's a cliché, she said. I've been out with men who never think about sex. Anyway, I just that moment had this revelation that I needed to stop thinking of him as a man and think of him as an individual, as just another human being. Just because he felt like sex doesn't mean he's not human. Madeline seemed to be missing the point. Yes, but with his son in the house? Well, if you're going to live with him, then you might have to get over that. Don't parents wait until their children are asleep? Wasn't the whole point of this story something to do with the expression on his face? Yes, that's right. So, when I declined his charming offer, he got this look on his face, and I think it might have been a sulky look. What do you mean you think? Well, the expression was only there for a flash. I think those people who specialize in detecting lies call it a micro-expression. After that, he was fine. We had a lovely dinner, and afterward we played Monopoly with his little boy, and that was fun. But I kept thinking about that face he pulled, that micro-expression, and I thought, is this a sign? Am I going to look back one day and say that was the moment I should have got out? Because that's what micro-expressions do. They reveal your true self. Ellen, this is the most stupid thing I've ever heard. The poor man is so enamored with you, he wants sex every second of the day. And when you turn him down, he shows the briefest look of disappointment. I know, I'm awful. Over-analytical. Hysterical. It's just that I want this one to work, Madeline. I really want this one to work. Well, of course you do, said Madeline crisply. So it's serious. The hypnotist has met Jack. As far as I know, that's the first woman he's introduced to Jack since me. I wonder what he thought of her. She doesn't really seem like a kid person. Too spiritual and floaty. Children like earthy, real people, who get down on the floor and play with them. I can't imagine someone who talks about light filling your body sitting in a sandbox. I guess Jack is too big for sandboxes now, although it's still there in their backyard. Sometimes, when Patrick is at work and Jack is at school, I go to the house and eat my lunch in the backyard. I sit there on the garden seat we bought on eBay, where I used to have my morning cup of tea, and I remember when this was my home. And this was my backyard. And this was my life. I always told him we needed a padlock for that back gate. I used to sit in that sandbox with Jack, and we'd play with his matchbox cars for hours. His dad did better sound effects than me, but I was more patient. Patrick was too much like a kid himself. He'd build this amazing racetrack through the sand, with bridges going over lakes, and then he'd get all frustrated when Jack suddenly decided to stand up and stomp on it. I'd say, "Patrick, he's 2 years old." Jack looked so tall and lanky when he got out of the car at the hypnotist's place. I was parked across the street. I just stayed there after my appointment with her. I'd had a feeling that Patrick was coming over for dinner. When she'd taken me upstairs, I'd smelled a garlic and wine sort of smell, like something marinating.
I didn't expect to see Jack come too. It gave me a shock. A sudden shock of indescribable pain, like when you're a kid and you're hit on the nose with a basketball on a cold morning and you cannot believe how much it hurts and your friends all laugh and you want your mother so bad. I don't think Jack was especially excited about meeting the hypnotist. He didn't look too happy. His shoulders were all slumped. I thought I saw him blowing his nose. I hope he doesn't have the flu. It's bad for people with underlying conditions like asthma. Once, when he'd just turned 3 and Patrick was away for work, Jack had an asthma attack in the middle of the night and I had to take him to emergency. I can still remember the terror I felt seeing his little chest heaving as he tried to suck in enough air, and the way his beautiful green eyes fixed on mine, begging me to help him, and then sitting there with him on my lap, trying to stop him from pulling off that stupid little plastic mask while they gave him Ventolin. The doctors and nurses all assumed I was his mother. How is Mum coping? Does Mum need a cup of tea? It would have been stupid to have corrected them and said I was just his stepmother. Does stepmom need a cup of tea? Jack called me Sass because that's what Patrick called me. Each night when I went in to say goodnight, he'd take his dummy out of his mouth. We didn't wean him off his dummy until he was nearly 4, which was very bad. We were soft with him. And say, "I love you, Sass," and quickly pop his dummy back in. And every time I felt like my heart would just about explode out of my chest. Jack was more than I'd ever hoped for, more than I'd ever dreamed. The night he had the asthma attack, they finally let us go home when the sun was coming up. I didn't want to put him in his cot, so I took him into our bed, and we both fell asleep. When I woke up, Patrick had got home from his trip, and he was just standing there watching us, with his look on his face. This look of tenderness and love and pride. And he said, "Hello, family." I'll never forget that look. 2 years later, 3 weeks after Jack started school, Patrick said, "I think it's over." "You think what's over?" I said cheerfully. That's how unexpected it was. I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. A TV series? The summer? He meant us. We were over. Chapter 6. The rejected stalker is often a former intimate partner with a complex, volatile mix of desire for reconciliation and revenge. Revenge for what? What did he do to her? Scribbled note by Ellen O'Farrell while Googling motivations for stalking. There were no more micro-expressions, or if there were, she didn't catch them. Her doubts drifted away like candle smoke. The first 2 weeks of July were glorious that year, shiny, blue-skied winter days as crisp and crunchy as apples. It was the perfect weather for a new relationship, for holding hands on public transport, for the sort of behavior that makes the recently broken-hearted want to weep and everyone else roll their eyes. Ellen collected memories, a remarkably lustful kiss pressed up against a brick wall like teenagers outside the Museum of Contemporary Art, a Sunday morning breakfast when she'd made him laugh so hard other people in the cafe turned to look, a mildly drunken game of gin rummy that ended in bed, coming home from yoga to find an enormous bunch of flowers lying on her doorstep with a note that said, "For my girl." They stopped being quite so careful with each other. "Jesus," said Patrick the first time he saw Ellen polish off a giant steak. "Aren't you meant to be a good Catholic boy?" said Ellen. "I wasn't using the Lord's name in vain. I was saying, 'Jesus, did you see what that woman just ate? I thought I was dating a hippy-dippy vegan chick, not a bloodthirsty carnivore. Hurry up or I'll eat yours.'" There was no sign of Saskia for a while. "Maybe I've scared her off,"
said Ellen, who was still idly researching the psychology of stalking whenever she had a spare moment.
Maybe. Patrick patted her arm in the kindly, worried fashion of a doctor responding to a terminal patient who says, Maybe I'll be the exception to the rule.
The words, I love you, began to hover in Ellen's thoughts, like a song lyric she couldn't get out of her head. She remembered reading somewhere, probably in a stupid magazine article, that it was fatal for the woman to say, I love you first, which is the most sexist, superstitious thing she'd ever heard. But still, there was no rush. They'd only been dating for 6 weeks. The right moment would present itself. She thought back over her previous I love you history. She'd been the first to say I love you to Andy. He'd looked momentarily terrified before he quickly, dutifully said that he'd loved her too. She also said it first to Edward, after drinking a particularly delicious strawberry daiquiri. She hadn't really meant it, to be honest. She meant that she loved strawberry daiquiris. Actually, now that she thought about it, she always took the lead. She'd written, I love you, on John's 38th birthday card, and he'd taken 42 humiliating days to say it back. It might be safer all round if Patrick said it first. And then he did. He stayed at her place one weeknight, and in the morning he was running late for an early appointment. He leaned over the bed, kissed her cheek, and said, Okay. Gotta go. Love you. Before rushing off. He'd said it in the exact same casual voice that he used on the phone to tell Jack that he loved him. It was clearly a slip of the tongue. She was pondering this, half amused, when she heard the sound of his footsteps pounding up the spiral staircase. She sat up in bed as he reappeared at her doorway.
Sorry, he said breathlessly, his hands gripping the door jamb. That was a mistake. Well, no, not a mistake. I was waiting for the perfect moment with moonlight and rainbows or whatever, and now I've blown it. Fool.
He slapped his forehead. He came and sat down on the bed next to her and looked at her in a way she didn't think she'd ever been looked at before, by anyone, lover or friend, as if nobody else had ever concentrated that hard. He said, I would like to make something very clear.
All right. Ellen made her face serious.
I am making this, declaration on the record. I am, of course, prepared to put it in writing, if necessary.
Right.
He cleared his throat. Ellen, I love you. I officially love you.
I love you too, said Ellen.
Officially, that is.
Right. Good then. Well, this has all worked out extremely well then.
He held out his hand and they shook hands, as if at the conclusion of a satisfactory business deal, except that before she could let go, he pulled her to him, rolled her onto her back, and kissed her hard. They sat back up, grinning idiotically at each other, and then Patrick looked at his watch.
Okay, so this sounds bad.
That's right, love me and leave me. He kissed her again and left. She lay back down and felt drenched with happiness. This was how love was meant to feel. Simple and peaceful and funny. Obvious. There was nothing to analyze. It seemed to her that she had never loved or been loved like this before. All those other times had been a wishy-washy imitation of the real thing. Just imagine if she'd gone her whole life without knowing that. Also, not that it mattered, it was just something interesting to note for future reference. He said it first. I rescheduled my appointment with a hypnotist because I had to go away to Melbourne for work. I tried to get out of it, but Trish supposedly came down with some terrible virus, and I was the only one available at short notice. Single, childless, woman. What else have you got to do? That's right, nothing. Patrick and I never went to Melbourne together, so there were no memories lurking on street corners. At first, it seemed like the trip was a good idea. The brooding skies and cruel breezes were a relief after Sydney's relentlessly cheery weather. Work kept me busy and distracted. I was tired at night and fell asleep straight away. But the longer I was away from Sydney, the more my desire grew to see Patrick and Ellen again. On Thursday morning, I woke up early, ravenous for information. What were they doing right that moment? Had he stayed at her place?
Had she stayed at his? My need to know felt physical, like a nutritional deficiency. I flew back to Sydney on the first flight out on Friday morning, my hands clenched around the armrests, leaning forward as if I could will the plane to go faster. I was a vampire and I needed blood.
It was Friday afternoon and Ellen was taking a moment in between appointments for some deep breathing and positive affirmations. She had a somewhat stressful weekend ahead of her. That night, Patrick was meeting Ellen's mother and godmothers for dinner, and the following evening, Ellen was being introduced to Patrick's family. On Sunday, Patrick was meeting Julia for the first time. They were having fish and chips at Watson's Bay, and Patrick's friend Stinky was coming along too to meet Ellen and also a possible match for Julia, although his name obviously didn't bode well. "Oh, he doesn't actually stink," Patrick had said, old chuckles at the thought of Stinky actually stinking. "That's just what we call him."
"So why do you call him that?"
Ellen had asked, but Patrick just chuckled.
Men were so strange sometimes.
They hadn't meant for all these introductions to happen on consecutive days. It just turned out that way because of various reasons, such as Ellen's mother suddenly rescheduling their dinner, and Stinky unexpectedly being in Sydney for the weekend. The weekend loomed in front of Ellen like a week of exams and dental appointments. She'd woken up that morning with a vague sense of dread, manifesting itself in an unpleasant feeling of nausea. It felt like a crowd of people was about to come stomping through the middle of their delicate new relationship, throwing about their opinions, asking questions, digging up flaws. Patrick and Ellen would see each other through the eyes of other people, people who mattered. Their perspectives would be like harsh, unflattering spotlights illuminating shadowy corners. Breathe in. She didn't give a fig what other people thought. Breathe out. Rubbish. She gave a whole fig tree. She wanted everyone she loved to love Patrick and everyone he loved to love her. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe. Forget it, she said out loud. She gave up trying to access her higher self and instead took a chocolate from her silver bowl, letting it dissolve slowly in her mouth. The chocolate was there for therapeutic purposes. It released the neurotransmitters, endorphins and serotonin, leading to a sense of well-being and even euphoria, which, as Julia said, was all just a complicated way of saying chocolate tastes good. Ellen closed her eyes for a moment and felt the warmth of the sun on her face. She was sitting in the recliner chair that her clients used. She often sat here and tried to imagine what it must be like for them, seeing her sit opposite them. Did they ever catch a glimpse of her doubts, or worse, her vanities? Did she look silly sitting there, with her legs so professionally, elegantly crossed? Did the sun shining through the window show up the little hairs and lines around her lips? She would bet that when Patrick was out on a job, leaning over to peer into his theodolite, lifting one arm high, he never felt a moment of self-consciousness. But it was different in a soft profession like hers, where there were still some people who thought she was akin to a magician, or a faith healer, or a fraud. She remembered meeting an old friend who said with genuine surprise, "You're not still doing that hypnosis stuff, are you?" As if it had just been a funny little phase. "It's my career," Ellen had told her. But the friend, a corporate lawyer, thought she was joking and laughed politely. In fact, it was more than a career. It was her passion, her calling, her vocation. The recliner was still warm from the last client who sat there, Deborah Vandenberg, the woman who suffered from unexplained, debilitating pain in her right leg if she walked for more than 10 minutes. Before coming to Ellen, she'd tried physiotherapists and chiropractors and sports doctors. She'd had x-rays and MRIs and exploratory surgery. There appeared to be no physical reason for the pain. The medical profession had basically shrugged their shoulders and said, "Sorry, we don't know." "I was very active," she told Ellen. "I loved bushwalking. Now some days when it's very bad, I find it hard to shop. This pain has changed almost everything about my life."
"Chronic pain does that," said Ellen.
She'd never experienced it herself, but over the years so many clients had brought her stories of how pain was a corrosive presence that cruelly ate away at all the simple pleasures of life. "But I may be able to help," she said.
"Everyone thinks they can help."
Deborah gave her a politely cynical smile.
"Until they give up on me."
She reminded Ellen a little of Julia. She was tall and confident, with short dark hair and a tomboyish grace as she sat back in her chair, one long black jeans leg entwined about the other. She had mentioned that she enjoyed cooking, so at their previous session, Ellen got her to imagine a stove dial she could use to turn her pain down. Today, as soon as they sat down, Deborah told Ellen that it was possible she'd turn her pain down one notch while walking through a car park that morning.
"But I probably imagined it," she said, as if suddenly doubting herself.
She had made it clear from the beginning that she was a skeptic. At the end of her